There are some upon this earth of yours who lay claim to know us, and who do their deeds of passion, pride, ill will, hatred, envy, bigotry, and selfishness in our name, who are as strange to us and all our kith and kin as if they had never lived. Remember that, and charge their doings on themselves, not us. Welcome back to the Book Wave, the Book Club podcast. I'm Scott, joined here today by Pat.
Hey,
Jason.
Good tidings we bring to you and your kin.
And William.
Hey, how are you now?
And today we're reading A Christmas Carol, classic by Charles Dickens. And my question to all three of you and to anybody listening at home in the comments section, you can answer down below. Have you been a Scrooge this year? And if so, what are you going to do to fix that? Are you one of the people that the Ghost of Christmas Present is talking about? Or are you going to make a change with your life? Let's start with you, Pat.
Well, I wouldn't exactly think that I'm a Scrooge in a way, because I've just been living an average, ordinary life and everything. I haven't really struck down anybody with my own verbal abuse of any kind. I guess in a way, if I wanted to change myself, it's just to, you know, be more communicative and just learn to be more optimistic, because, you know, despite our undoings and everything like that, especially this year, I guess it's just always important to just realize our own common humanity. You know, we're all the same species. We all have an ability to choose our own life and how we can change it, instead of just living the same old routine over and over again and just making things worse for everybody. And just keeping that in mind while we discover our own purpose. And also not to hoard any of the sugar cookies.
Yeah. Those sugar cookies are little demons.
It's an interesting point you bring up, Pat. That whole remembering that we're all human and all experiencing this crazy year. I think there's something to be said about a lockdown and a news radio cast that really separates individuals in times like these. It's like, for the longest time, I would wake up and go for a walk and just look at the roads and be like, it took hundreds of people to do this. Like, I need to stop taking existence for granted. And I'm going to do that by looking at roads and remembering how hard that is. Because you can just get into this routine of, well, the world's shut down and everything's awful. So I'm not even going to think about trying to interact with humankind, because I need to social distance and wear a face covering. And there's only 10 people allowed in the store. So I'm not going to hold up the line by having a conversation and seeing how someone is at the till.
Mm-hmm.
But that hurts the spirit, man.
Yep.
Yeah, it really does. In a way, the best thing you can do for your community is to, you know, sacrifice that connection with your community. It's kind of hard to walk that line sometimes.
One of the descriptions that Charles Dickens gave for Ebenezer Scrooge has come to have been known for just being a cold-hearted person, but Dickens described him as being solitary, secretive, and self-contained, like an oyster. And especially during these times of lockdowns, I felt like that. And even when there weren't lockdowns, I know I've caught myself feeling self-contained and isolating myself from other people. And in that respect, I could see myself as a Scrooge, even if it's not something that I want for myself and others, because, you know, it's about being selfish. It's about thinking about yourself and not the goodwill of mankind around you. I think that's kind of what the epitome of being an Ebenezer Scrooge is.
Hmm. That reminds me a lot of when we were reading Beyond Good and Evil about Friedrich Nietzsche and talking about how he would just isolate himself entirely and how he just thrived on solitude. So maybe he's another comparison to Ebenezer Scrooge, just the high-class intellectual that thinks he's too good for all these lowly, slave mentality or slave morality people all around him.
Yeah, I think it's an easy delusion to fall into of being alone, being an island. But if you look at it from a bigger picture perspective, everything's interconnected. So no matter how much you want to isolate, you're going to be part of a greater good, hopefully. But I mean, we all walk on the bridges that our ancestors and our fellow men have created. And so if you're isolating yourself, not being compassionate, only thinking about selfish ends, the kind of bridge that you're going to make isn't one that everyone else will be able to find useful.
Yeah, and also to continue down the whole solitude, living in solitude thing, we all know that that when Scrooge is dreaming and he meets the ghosts, the three ghosts of Christmas, we as readers know that it's all a dream. They're not real. Even though they show different parts of everything that they show to Scrooge in a way. We see his own mind while he is in his own bedroom all alone on Christmas Eve. And in a way, as he's ex as a, as he's exploring, this gives him an idea of who he really is as he progresses throughout until the morning he wakes up. So there is some benefit to that where even if you don't fully understand, even if you think you know yourself fully, there's always a lot of things in your own consciousness that slowly unpack. And then you look at that and think, gee, I never really thought about that. Was this here this entire time? Did I not realize it?
I would like to come back to that, whether this was a dream or some sort of psychedelic vision. Maybe he ate something. But staying with the topic of solitude, I thought what was really interesting is how far removed our current society is from the time that this took place in the Victorian era. Because Charles Dickens was born in the early 1813-ish. And so I'm assuming this story took place maybe around 1830.
Yeah, it was a Christmas Carol was published in 1843. That's the year I found.
Okay, perfect. So what was going on in the world at this time was you had people that had previously lived in rural areas, and now they've all come into the city. You had hundreds of thousands of people coming into the city, living in unhygienic conditions. You had multiple families living in the same house. So you'd probably end up sleeping on the floor. And maybe if you're lucky, you'd have like a bed made of hay. But just this, if you've ever lived in a big city, it's really easy to find yourself feeling quite lonely because there's so many new faces. It can be easy to make friends, but it can also be a daunting task. And what I found interesting is just this, after reading the story, I went back and started researching Victorian era life, how they worked, how they lived in a home. And we have so much like now in our current society that these people didn't have, luxuries that we often take for granted.
It's funny because the first thing that I thought of is I bet that they had their milk delivered. And it's like one extra human interaction that we don't have anymore.
Yeah, it'd be delivered on a street full of horse manure.
That's true. And I think chambermaids would work like 16 to 20 hour days just taking care of a house back then.
Yeah, like when you think about it, how much social interaction did they really have over us? Like if you're working 16 hours instead of 8, you're still going to have to sleep, right? So how much time does that leave for, you know, just talking with your children or your spouse? It's just like, no, they're busy cooking and cleaning and building and working and whatever else.
Yeah, and I mean, Scrooge went on about the surplus population. I think this was just for all the people coming into the city in droves. But when I thought back on it, they have all these hours of work. They have to sleep and eat. When did they have time to populate and fornicate?
Well, that was like the only form of entertainment they had. Like, you know, 15 minutes before they go to bed, gotta do something, right?
Yeah, and I guess you wouldn't want to spend too long doing that because the smells back then might not have been great.
Yeah.
Time it right after your monthly shower.
Yeah.
And the cultural barriers, too. Like, we're talking about a time where there was still very clearly defined distinctions between classes in this society. Like, there were simply things that you just didn't talk about. There were simply people you just didn't talk to. And, you know, like, to know one's place in society. Like, that's very Brave New Worldy, that sort of time where it's like, you are a poor person. You don't make eye contact with rich people.
Don't speak unless you're spoken to.
Yeah, like that whole weird caste system where they're not like separated from each other. All the poor and the rich people are mingled in the same neighborhood. And like that's an extra layer of solitude and division of communities. Like you can't even talk to your neighbor from three doors down because, you know, they're from the wrong caste. And I guess Scrooge puts himself in like a whole class or caste of his own because, you know, like the only person he ever like considers to be his equal is Jacob Marley, who he references as being like an old miser, just like he is now, like ripping off the poor and rich man alike.
Is this what Rodya Raskolnikov had in mind of his picture of an Ubermensch?
That's a good question right there.
Why, thank you.
Because we've already compared him to Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. So, like, comparing him to Dostoevsky's Rodya Raskolnikov isn't much of a stretch after that.
Right? Like, is this what he would have looked like had he, you know, buried his emotions and succeeded in stealing from the pawnbroker? Would he have established himself a capital kingdom and, you know, pushed everybody away because of obligation and necessity to keep himself from trapping himself in the lies and the murders and the deceits? How cold would he become?
Well, I saw Scrooge as belonging to the owner class. They might have referred to them as masters back then. And these were the cornerstones of the culture. They owned the building. They owned the businesses. And the working class was really, you know, there were so, like we mentioned, there were so many people. The working class had to really carve out a niche for themselves, because if they were to do poor quality work, they could easily be replaced. And so from that mindset of an owner, if you can just easily replace, you have disposable workers, I think it would be easy to dehumanize.
It still is, isn't it? I don't know how much that's changed. I've worked in some factories. But like they respect you while they disrespect you these days. They'll look at you in the eyes and ask you how your day is going while they're planning on letting you go tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, there's always that mask that gets put in between those kind of interactions.
But it's still like when you go to a factory, they give you the metaphor like your place here is similar to that of putting your hand in a bucket of water. And when you take it out, notice how much the bucket of water has changed. Like,
yeah.
It does.
Someone
no
else's hand is going to do the exact same thing.
Yeah. But it's weird to think that Scrooge he wasn't hurt, theoretically, right? Like, he was born into royalty almost, right? And raised and indoctrinated in a society that told him to be this way, theoretically.
Yeah, that's actually a question. Does it say that he was born rich, or does it say that he created his fortune from the ground up? Because that would be a big distinction between someone like Scrooge and someone like Hank Reardon, like we were talking about before we started recording. Because it's pretty hard not to see the similarities between the objectivist worldview and how Ebenezer Scrooge handled his affairs.
Well, of the three ghosts that visit him, the first one of Christmas Past shows him as a young boy, essentially all alone. They don't indicate where his father was, but I don't know if he was sent away or his father was angry at him, but it showed him reading, just reading and devouring books. And I got the impression that he kind of built himself up.
Yeah.
But regardless, it kind of shows him as somebody who's wealthy. But even with all his wealth, he doesn't purchase comforts. You know, he lives in a simple house. It might be bigger than other people's, but he doesn't have creature comforts and surround himself with heating. He lets his house get cold. Because he doesn't want to spend the money.
It mentions he uses a comforter because he doesn't want to spend the little money on a jacket. So.
Yeah, in a way.
He doesn't do nesting.
In a way, that kind of routine of just devouring books after book after book and then just growing up trying to build yourself. That too can also provide a bit of resentment too, as a way of being a defense mechanism, because there's so much knowledge to devour, and it turns you into something else entirely. And I guess in a way, Scrooge was using what he has learned to make himself stronger and not let any kind of emotion get attached to him.
The will to power.
Yeah. He just let that own desire. Well, he just let the idea of rising into power and earning as much money as possible expand. Just let that. He just lets that. And he just let those things in as his default setting.
Yeah, the ghost of Jacob Marley described him as having a worldly mind. When you were talking about closing yourself off, I was thinking, can you be a compassionate person if you close yourself off to your emotions? Or do you have to let yourself feel everything in order to get this transcendent quality, the hero's journey that we see happen by the end of this book?
I think I don't have the answer to that question, but I will tackle it. But I think it's somewhere on the spectrum, right? Like, when it comes to being compassionate, you have to have, and the word compassionate has sort of mutated. Like, compassion and empathy and sympathy have gotten sort of conflated and then messed around in the past 15 years or so. So I think compassion is more to do with understanding what they're going through and working with them, much like empathy used to be. But you don't want to just be empathetic, which is what empathetic has become, where it's like you're taking on their emotions. So it's like someone's going through something and it's like, oh, I completely feel that. And it's like, well, that doesn't help me. Yeah, like, I'd like you to understand that.
Yeah, it's about understanding each other, not about, you know, taking on the same virus, you know. Like, giving you my depression isn't going to help me get less depressed.
Like, there are people that have been saying and self-describing themselves as empaths, you know, people that can feel other people's emotions. They see someone sad and they're sad. And it's like, that's a broken emotional strategy. Humans mirror neurons. So when you see someone sad, you're likely to get a little sad. But if you can't identify the fact that your emotions are coming externally and you don't have the control to decide what state you're in, that's a problem, because emotions are 7 seconds. And if someone else is stuck in an emotion, and because you saw them, you got stuck in that emotion, you're not going to help them get out of it. Like, you need to know what they're going through. You need to understand how that feels, and you need to have a strategy to get out of that feeling. You need to have like sensory stimulation that makes you feel better. And you need to have a plan. You need to be able to think different stuff. And if someone's stuck ruminating and dealing with an experience, and you just get right down to like bedrock with them.
Yeah. I can definitely relate to what you're saying. Like, I definitely have felt like that kind of person in the past, especially being like if you don't have like an identity or a sense of self, let's say, it's so much easier to let other people's emotions affect you. Cause like, when you're in like a codependent relationship, and you base your entire identity on another person, and then you're interacting with other people, you have the same kind of mindset, like, oh no, I'm just here for the other person. And that's one of the things that leads you into becoming an NPC.
It's literally the shirt, I'm with stupid.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's your identity? You are with stupid. Okay.
Yeah, you've made that choice. That's what you have to realize. Your identity is the choice that you've made to be with stupid. So what does that say about you?
Or it's the corporate logo that you decide to wear. Like, this is where you get your stuff from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's like, so, and I was the same way in the past, and I still am to a very large degree that I'm unhappy with, but at least I'm aware of it. I got a call a couple months ago from a friend who was really stressed out, and they called me, and the first thing they said was, I don't want to feel this stressed out. And instead of saying, okay, let's not feel that stressed out, I was like, well, why are you stressed out? And they started explaining, and as they started explaining what happened, their brain, hallucinating and not differentiating between reality, started to experience the emotions even more. And I was like, wait a second, this is everything I hate about therapy. Stop telling me about the problem. Let's just get rid of it. And so what you do is you transition from talking about what happened to, you have an emotion and it's an experience in your body. Where is the emotion biggest? What shape is it? What color is it? And what direction is it rotating? It's like, okay, well, it's brown and it's in my chest and it's spinning clockwise really fast. I was like, okay, so you've just imagined something. I'd like to ask you to imagine it slowing down and then spinning in the opposite direction. And they do that, and then they spin it back in the opposite direction, they shrink it, and then they move it out of their body, and the emotion's gone. Because emotions have very little to do with reality, and emotional regularity has very little to do with reality. It's just what you tell yourself in the moment that allows your brain to produce the chemicals that transition you to a better state. And that's why empathy isn't always useful.
That right there is the perfect segue to go back to this whole fever dream idea that Pat was talking about. Because you used the words that none of this was real. And I would invoke my favorite line from Harry Potter at this point. You know when, like, Harry's having that dream or whatever and he sees Dumbledore in either the last movie or the second last movie? In the last book, anyway. Where he says, he turns to Dumbledore and he says, hey, wait a second. Is this "Is this real or was it all in my head?" And Dumbledore turns to him and says, "Well, of course it was all in your head, Harry, but why on earth should that mean it wasn't real?" Like, these experiences, I don't care what this experience came from. Like, if Ebenezer had this experience from, you know, a bad mushroom, bad gravy, swallowed a toothpick, like he mentions in the prose, it doesn't matter where it came from. If it actually happened, if God sent him an angel, this was a real experience, and you can't discount that at all, because this one experience that Ebenezer had, you could say it was a hallucination, it wasn't real, but it was the most profound experience of this fictional character's life. It changed every action he did afterwards. So it doesn't really matter if it's real, where it came from. Just like when we talk about Socrates or Jesus, it doesn't matter if they really lived. We still have the writings. We still have the books. We still have the lessons.
And you can relate to the experience. Mm-hmm. You can gain some understanding. One of the words that I've started using more often when referring to this sort of event is it's an ordeal. And I think there's a direct relationship to how much you suppress your shadow and how big the ordeal is going to end up being. But when we're growing up and we have authority figures and they tell us something, we either accept it as truth or we don't. And whether or not it's truth is neither here nor there. What happens is if those beliefs that we have develop into detrimental things, we'll need an ordeal to learn something new. Because, like, I could tell you right now that the earth is flat, but you're not going to believe me just as much as I could tell you if the earth is round. It doesn't matter what shape I try to convince you the earth is. You're not just going to completely change your existence based on this truth that I've shared with you and, you know, manifested into your belief system. But you need an ordeal.
You could also split that into two realities. Like, if you look at the world symbolically, you look all around you and you say, well, I can't perceive that I'm on a ball, so as far as it matters, my world is flat. I'm not saying the planet's flat, but it doesn't give me anything extra to say.
Maybe that wasn't the best example, but like the idea of requiring something that require, like it demands your focus and attention. There's a risk of failure and a huge amount of growth, like this ordeal experience that Scrooge went through. You know, he could have come out of it worse or way greater, and thank goodness he did. But that's the only way to learn those things.
Or given a third choice, which is not making a decision of whether or not he believes that he will forever suffer with regret, or choose to accept who he is and then change for the better. He could just stay in this limbo-esque level where he can just continue to imagine which choice is the best, is the better.
I would argue that his whole life was that limbo, and that limbo made manifest the visits of the spirits for his ordeal that required him to change. And I think that if he hadn't have changed, he may have just died.
And I guess the turning point of that is when the Ghost of Christmas Present, I think it was, said, and I have the quote here, it says, "Why did I walk through crowds of fellow beings with my..." Well, actually, it might have been Scrooge, now that I think about it. "Why did I walk through crowds of fellow beings with my eyes turned down and never raised them to that blessed star which led the wise men to a poor abode? Were there no poor homes to which its light would have conducted me?" And I think that's the turning point of whether or not he has suffered a huge regret and not choosing to help out the poor, not choosing to help out his fellow neighbors and everything.
Yeah, and he asks the Ghost of Christmas Present when they're walking through the streets, like, "Don't these people have anywhere to go?" And then the ghost quotes him when he was talking to the charity people, like the guys looking for donations for the poor. He says, are there not prisons for these people? Like, what about the surplus population you were talking about before? And it's just like, oh man, that hits pretty hard.
It's like, almost like, go ahead, Jason.
Well, I was just going to add on that for people who couldn't hack it at work, their options were the workhouse, which is kind of like a government-funded work camp, but it was meant to be very harsh. They wanted you to not stay there because you would get free food, a roof over your head. So they would work you to do impossible tasks like breaking up stone, breaking up bone. And if you couldn't cut it at the workhouse, prison was your next option. You would be arrested and thrown into the prison by the magistrate, or just thrown out on the street to starve.
Yeah, and Scrooge makes a point. There's like, I already give my fair share of donations to the prisons and the workhouses. Why can't these people go there? It's just like, well, a lot of these people would rather die than go to these places. It's like, well, maybe they should decrease the surplus population. It's like, damn, dude, that's a little harsh. That's where I think it goes a little bit further than the Hank Reardon character that we were talking about.
Yeah, way further. He's genuinely disinterested up until a certain point in the problems of the world, right? Like, he's right. Turned a blind eye to reality, and he's trying to maintain his own hallucination, his own dream. And it's very Eckhart Tolle, this whole thing, this whole I can't live with myself experience that he's having, and that he's manifested these spiritual sort of avatars of all of the experiences he had and all of the lessons he didn't learn, so that he can have this debate in a safe space and transcend his awful belief system and become something worth living for.
A minute ago, we were talking about ordeals, and I was thinking from a spiritual perspective or a psychedelic perspective that you could see life itself as the great ordeal. You could see this year as an ordeal, or this day, or even just this very moment as an ordeal. And how are you going to respond to that? Are you going to close down, shut yourself off, or are you going to think about your fellow man? And if you were in a position that these workers were in, it would be very difficult to kind of have that big view and, you know, I want to be not necessarily happy, but I want to be content with life, and I want to spread what little joy that I can cultivate. But that's what I saw in the characters when I read about them, that the ghost of Christmas present was kind of sprinkling hope to these people, and they would take that hope and they would share it and at least attempt to give hope to other people, even though their daily ordeals were quite harsh.
I think the problem with life as the grand ordeal is the omnipotence of it, that it's intangible, that it isn't an ordeal. It's a campaign, or a campaign of campaigns, or some sort of epic that you can't simply, like, I feel like an ordeal has to be this huge sort of ineffable thing, and also feel like a Rupi Kaur poem, like a haiku, where it's like everything is so messed up until the climax of the ordeal, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, my belief is wrong, and I need to make a non-negotiable pact with myself that I never live this way again, because it's so plainly obvious to me now. But with life, it's like,
yeah, to use religious language would be like an epiphany or revelation.
Yes, 100%.
If you bring in the idea of reincarnation, though, you could live your life as this great ordeal, and then at the time of death, you either realize or you don't, you know, what you need to make changes for in the next life.
I think the way you're talking about it, it makes me think of the movie Rocky. And Stallone himself selling that script and guaranteeing himself that that would be his role. Like, that's a man who said, life is my ordeal, and I'm just going to fight it every damn day of the week. And it's like, holy shit, this is the kind of person that can pull themselves up by their bootstraps. I am not. The ordeal of life makes me want to hide in my bed. I'm more like the ordeal of having a good coffee on my own terms. Because I don't like Tim Hortons. You know, something's small.
Yeah, and then you get bigger. Ordeals. Extrapolate to the big ordeals later.
It's like, my star's over here, I'm going to shoot for here.
Yes, the old Petersonian.
There was this quote by Jacob Marley in the book where he says, it's required of men that their spirit should walk among fellow man and travel far and wide. But if the spirit does not travel in life, it will be condemned to do so after death. And so that's where I got the idea that, and it's not my idea, and I'm most likely wrong, that this idea taken from Hinduism and Buddhism of reincarnation, that if you do good deeds in this life and you pull the weeds of hatred, greed, and delusion, that maybe, just maybe, you'll have a better life next go around.
I think, because we were talking about the almost toxic independence of Scrooge earlier, and I think that the nature of humans is to be interdependent, and we were talking, of course, about the codependency and that issue, but we need people, and we need spirituality, and we need routine, and we need chaos, and we need spontaneity, but it's, we also need balance. And I think that a lot of people see the struggle of maintaining relationships as this chaotic, unbalanceable thing that doesn't fit the boxes of their scheduler, and so they give up on it. And it's like, no. That's not how it works. You don't win that way. You lose something when you say no to going out and doing community service or going to mass, whatever your mass is, whatever your religion is, whatever your godhead appears to you as. Like, you need to do these things to feel full and to live life with a capital A, being alive and being enthusiastic. And it's demanding. You know, loving is harder than hating. And growing for tomorrow is harder than eating candy and playing video games and going to bed at 4. But I'll tell you, the latter does not make you feel better.
Have you been watching me?
We're deep into December in Canada, my friend. I know what's happening.
The holidays are right around the corner, so, you know, it's that time of year.
But it's like, I was having this conversation with my buddy the other day that love and hatred are equally powerful energies. And his argument wasn't that hate was stronger than love. And of course, this is all very out there, bullshitty kind of hypothetical conversation. But his idea was that it's so much easier to hate that there's an abundance of it, which makes it outweigh love every day of the week. And confronted with those odds, what's the point?
Not to mention, it's pretty popular too.
Well, in freakout culture.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like in just how we assign value to precious metals today. It's like the scarcity of it is what gives it its value.
What if the relationship between love and hate is similar to that of the ocean and an iceberg, where you have these emotions made of the same elements, oxygen and hydrogen, but they're in completely different form.
Be watching, my friend. It can flow or it can crash. Anybody know the Bruce Lee quote I'm talking about?
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to make a simple metaphor. I almost want to compare it. Like, if it's going to be water, then it's salt water and it's fresh water. And it's like, yeah. You can do You can do a lot with salt water. Like if someone has, like, you'd look at a bad father, I think is the easiest way to talk about the love-hate relationship, where if your father has yelled at you because you've made a mistake versus encouraging you to do better, like that's still energy output towards loved one. Whereas the neutral, the lack of looking in and giving feedback, that's the real sin in fatherhood, you know, literally walking away and not being there. And I'm not supporting, you know, abusive fathers, and God, I hope that we can get rid of them all one day. But the idea that if he didn't care about you at all, he wouldn't even be yelling at you in the first place is the broken belief system that he has, that he's running. And he doesn't have emotional regulation. But maybe eventually you can get something out of that where it's like, oh, I was living wrong, and that's why he was yelling. And now that I'm doing it right, he doesn't yell at me anymore. And honestly, I'm better off for it. And it's like, that's like dropping off 1,000 gallons of salt water to people that are thirsty. It's like, yeah, it will help eventually if they can boil it and purify it. But can't you just give them fresh water?
Yeah, they both have their utility for sure. Reminds me of that movie Whiplash. Like, that movie made me cry. Holy.
But it's
Well,
like the
and
amount of
also.
work it took me to explain the benefit that comes from a hateful action sort of demonstrates the point that you should just raise your children with love, hopefully.
It's a sense of moral responsibility in a way. And it's also mentioned in the story where mankind was his own business, and it's like the dealings of a trade where you can offer charity, you can offer mercy, or you can offer forbearance or benevolence or whatever emotion you can. And just let that go through, and you can either accept it, or you can ignore it, or you can deny it.
Oh, and it's like that belief that business isn't about emotions and it's logic and it's deals and it's cost versus, I don't know, risk. I don't know. I'm not a business person. But it's like, what's the point of doing business as a human, as an emotional creature, if there isn't some jewel of emotion in it? Like, why are you doing it? And it's like, if you didn't even know that you could be doing it for something more than money, like, how are you doing it? And then it's like, what are you doing? But most people are just like, I'm going to make money by selling wood. Grab their axe and they go and they chop wood and they come home and their hands are sore and their body is sore and they're broken and they beat their wife and it's the 1600s and life is awful. But
Well, with
now we
Scrooge,
have.
I mean, his whole business, I believe, was law. He was in the business of counting money, and money is a promise to the future, but he didn't really use it that way. He just used it as a place setter in his position in society. He didn't before the story, before the ghost. He's not donating the money. He's not doing goodwill with his money. He's just collecting it in like Scrooge's vault. It's just like the duck swimming in his vault of gold, if you will. But then we have a transition by the end of the story where, yeah, he has all this money, but now he realizes that he has the capacity to do something good with it.
Yeah, it's almost like he was worth a lot, but he offered no value.
And you see the Ghost of Christmas Future shows him what happens to that amassment of wealth that he's collected. Like, he gives bed curtains to his family in the will, and like these little insignificant things, and there's no notion of what happened to the money at all. Like, probably just got collected by the government if he's not gonna give it to his family members who he thinks are worthy of it.
And if we go back to the three ghosts, starting with the Ghost of Christmas Past, it shows the story of Scrooge becoming the miser he is. And the central factor that I read into it was money. He just became very greedy, and it's through that that he became selfish. He from the Buddhist terminology, he started grasping at the world, clutching onto things, closing his heart.
Yeah, they show him the vision of like his old girlfriend. He's like, oh, how in love I was with her and all this. And then it's like the next vision right after that is like, you've turned away from us and now you only worship money. So, you know, either marry me or I'm out of here. At least that's how it went down in the Daisy Duck cartoon or whatever that was. Daisy Duck version. What was that, Will?
It's almost a story of addiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, the addiction is the money, right?
Yeah, and addiction to wealth and status and capital. And, you know, I mentioned this in another video before, but, like, if you're into your Christian mythology and all this occultism, you could say he turned to the god Mammon. So, the representation of greed.
Right.
Yeah, the devil.
Or in American Gods, the god of money.
So yeah. I like to think of Scrooge as a little boy where he loved the world unconditionally, but then he grew up to apply a conditional love on it. He would only love the world or those aspects of the world if they brought him some kind of profit, if they brought him gain. And if you were not involved in that transaction, if you weren't part of his business or you were a bad worker and were costing him money, he would cut you off. No more love for you. And so I was actually curious if you guys thought of the three ghosts as being metaphors for anything. So maybe like the ghost of Christmas past. For example, I thought the ghost of Christmas future was a metaphor for death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely got some of those vibes. Yeah. He did show him his death, and he was dressed up like the Grim Reaper. And he was completely silent the whole time. Didn't say anything. The Scrooge McDuck cartoon deviated from that minor detail.
I guess, would you guys think that the ghost of Christmas past was maybe metaphorical for our memories?
Yeah, in a way. It does serve memory. Because it shows not only what you have done in your past life, but also shows you what to remember, where you came from.
Yeah, it's like your origin story.
Yeah.
But not even, because it's tainted by your own biases.
Yeah, that was another little thing, too. Like, he was being showed his memories, not how the past objectively happened. Because wasn't there, like, one part where he's just like, oh, Captain Ahab just showed up. Oh, it's a... What's the other one from the...
He was remembering all of the characters from the books.
Yeah, but like he was remembering them as if they were like showing up to his house in his childhood. He's just like, oh, look, it's old Alibaba. How joyful of a guy he was. And he remembers like as an infant, he remembers Alibaba just coming to his house.
Right.
And he's like, well, that's a neat little detail. Just like showing him again, reminding him what it was like to, you know, experience the mind of a child, because that's a lot like of what Nietzsche and Jung say too, that a lot of like what growing up and maturing and coming into your own is remembering that childlike wonder that you left behind in the slog of life, you know?
I believe Buddha says something similar too.
Yeah. All knowing is remembering. I think that's something along the lines of what his message was.
Yeah, in a way, when we think about memories from our past and having that childlike sense of wonder, we are entranced by it. And it's the only thing that can give us joy. But the problem is, even though we have access to that memory, we cannot relive it in the present. We can't go back to it.
One metaphor that I kind of pulled from the whole journey was kind of a loose allegory or comparison to Dante's Inferno. So yeah, at the very beginning, he has like the visitation from Marley, which could be like, you know, Beatrice first appearing to Dante. And then when he starts being guided by Virgil, or the spirit of Christmas past, takes him straight to the underworld and shows him all the garbage that he did not want to see. Like digging up everything from his past that made him into the miserable old man that he is now. And then once you get into the Christmas present, it's like he's ascending back up into purgatory. So you get that little glimmer of light. So it's like, well, there's a chance that he can make it. He can do something here. The Christmas present is showing him kind of the route to redemption. And then when he gets to the Ghost of Christmas Future, it's just like, okay, this is the end. This is revelation, or, you know, you're doomed. You're just gonna either keep building that chain that you saw dragging Marley down, or you make the change. You accept the Christmas spirit and you be a better man in your community. You do better by others, love thy neighbor, see yourself as a node in a network, and you can create a better life for yourself without all of this horrible regret that's going to give you these demonic fever dreams on Christmas Eve.
There was a really good quote where Marley is saying that he wears the chain forged that he forged in life, that it's full of money boxes, full of heavy purses, keys and beads. And I was thinking that memories can fill your chain. You know, we all have a chain that our body, you know, binds us to this life. And our memories are attached to that chain, kind of like a lucky bracelet or something. You have little mementos. So if you fill your chain with acts of good deeds, compassion, that at least you can remember those things. So in the present moment, you might be a little bit more likely, a little bit more open to that side, instead of saying no and closing yourself off.
Yeah, I like that. It's like you're forging your chain, and like the chain is made up of these memories, and you really get to choose like how you build that chain. Do you make it nice and light and easy to bear, or do you make it the source of all your suffering?
So kind of like Kingdom Hearts in a way. You forge your own Keyblade.
There you go.
Good game. That's a good game. I think, though, to some extent, you know, you got to ask the weird metaphysical questions. Like, to what degree is the chain built for you? To what degree... If, you know, we say reincarnation's a thing, or we say past life experiences and karma are a thing, like, at what point during our creation did we choose the parents and the country that we were born to? And what experiences did we miss out on that necessitated us experiencing the things that we're experiencing in this lifetime? And to what degree did the experiences and the learnings that we had cause us to have the learnings and experiences that we need next? And how much control do we have over the building of our chain? And at what point has the chain built itself enough for us to be able to look at it and say, I want to do something differently now?
So kind of like Fable in a way.
Well, and it's that question of like, does the soul know what it needs to learn in this lifetime? Is fate and destiny a thing? Those are some fun questions to ask around Christmas time, aren't they?
Oh yeah. Very tender.
Very tender. Moist.
There was one of the fates that the Ghost of Christmas Future brought to Scrooge, and it showed him dead in bed, and that some looters had essentially stolen all of his belongings, his curtains from his bedroom, whatnots. And it hit hard for me, because if you do shut yourself down and isolate and you don't have children, you're not close to your family. When you die, those looters were kind of a metaphor for the government, you know, taking your, you won't have anything left to inherit to your family if you're closed off like that.
Yeah, in a way, especially the curtains too. I looked at those curtains as a way of just, and then being stripped off as like being a part of Scrooge in a way. He loses that part of himself.
Those are the kind of parts that constantly remind me of Atlas Shrugged too. It's like, Will and I, at least, we love poking holes in objectivism. And it's just like, you work your whole life for yourself to create all this wealth. But as we know, none of the objectivists in her story had any children. So where does that wealth go afterwards? I mean, I guess you would say you leave it to, you know, a worthy predecessor, someone who you accept in life as being, you know, an acceptable person to leave the family business with. And, you know, to hell with family ties. Blood doesn't mean anything if you're an objectivist.
Yeah, and that's the problem, isn't it? Like, what's the point then? Why? Like, why would you work for yourself if you're just going to leave it to your successor? Like, and especially in Atlas Shrugged, everything they built was destroyed by the government there. So it was just like...
Yeah. They use the term looter quite liberally to describe the government. So I didn't even have to think twice when the word looter came up in A Christmas Story. I'm like, oh, they're talking about the government. It got seized in taxes and all this and all that.
Yeah.
So like there's definitely some parallels here, and I'd almost like to see Ayn Rand's rebuttal to it. I'd like to see like a whole like speech about Ayn Rand talking about Ebenezer Scrooge, just her character breakdown of this one individual and where did he go wrong, if he even did. I'd really like to see a real objectivist's answer to that question.
While we're on that thread, I'd like the communist analysis of how capitalism is the real criminal in this story, and that in a communist society, Scrooge never would have existed, because he just never would have existed.
Well, Scrooge in communism, Scrooge never would have existed because rich people weren't a thing in communism.
Exactly. Yeah. As such, capitalism is the real villain.
Yeah.
I mean, during this time of the Victorian era, there was quite a bit of free market enterprise going on, where you as a worker, you might make, okay, so Scrooge's clerk, he made 15 pence an hour. You could go over to the foundry, somebody's maybe making 4 pence a day. They go pick that up at the pub, and the foundry owner and the pub have a deal where, you know, he gives the pub owner the money. The workers go in there to get the money, but at the same time they're at the pub, so they're going to get a drink that gets deducted from their pay. They might pay a person to come by, knock on the door to wake them up, you know, at 5 a.m. because they don't have clocks. They're not going to be able to get up. So that's another job where they're paying somebody. They're typically, I read that they're renting out most of the homes these people lived in on a weekly basis.
It's funny you bring that up. I actually have a sign from the area that we're in, that I'm in, from a grain elevator sometime in the past 100 years. And the sign was at the bar, and it was roughly along the lines of, the bar was closed except for 2 grain elevator workers on payday, basically. Oh. It was just like completely set up. You go, you get your money at the bar, you spend all your money at the bar, you go home.
What a racket.
But I guess one of the questions I had after we get to the end of the book, where Scrooge has this transcendent moment and he's giving all this money away, how long can he keep this up?
Well, like with most stories like this, I would just say it's up to the audience to decide. Let their imaginations run wild with it. There's not going to be a definitive answer that you may look for at the very last page, but at least you have a good idea, maybe, about what happens next.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't say he gives away all his money, and it's something that any one of us could deal with on a daily basis. If you're walking down the sidewalk, a city park, and there's somebody there that is sitting on the ground, they have a sign up, maybe that says, "It's a beautiful day, I'm blind." They have a little cup that you can put money in. You got to ask yourself, okay, am I going to give this person money? What about the next person and the person after that? You can't give every panhandler a dollar, because then you won't have any. But if you at least give one of them a donation, I think that's better than nothing. It's like a good middle ground.
Yeah, I think, well, you could always think of like the Scrooge McDuck characterization of it, where he's got like the swimming pool full of gold, but it doesn't really seem like the authentic Ebenezer Scrooge has those kind of resources. So he might run out of money a lot quicker than you would expect. But I think like the main takeaway from the story is just that it was a mindset change. Got a little carried away with the gratitude on Christmas and stuff, and he's gonna keep celebrating Christmas the same way, but you know, during the year, he's just going to make the conscious effort to, you know, not make money that number one high priority, and, you know, show more love and respect to his nephew, Fred, and maybe not scream at him and throw his reef away and, you know, like a cartoon, just throw the reef down and trap him and kick him out of your door. You're going to be a little bit more kind to Donald Duck and Mickey. And at the end of the Scrooge McDuck cartoon, he makes Mickey his partner, so you know it's a happy ending. He gets a raise and everything.
Yeah, this book had a happy ending too. Tiny Tim did not die, and yeah. The author brings up this idea of the total abstinence principle at the very end, and I looked into that, and they're not talking about like avoiding vices. They're talking about abstinence of greed and hatred that really had come to define Scrooge as a person.
And his heart grew 3 sizes that day.
And he died immediately, because that is an unhealthy amount for the heart to grow.
At least he died.
You have right. To ruin it for me.
What an unexpected heart condition. His poor chest cavity was just crushed.
Oh, shit.
This
well, and a Merry Christmas to all.
And to all a good night. God bless us. Everyone,
don't forget to subscribe.
God yeah. Bless ye merry gentlemen, may nothing you dismay.
Sing it, Jason.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And remember, this Christmas, if you're looking to give away a loonie to a joyous group of 4 young men panhandling,
please, sir.
Go ahead.
I want some more.
/bookwave.
Yep, we have a little donation box. You can donate, you know, one time or monthly. It's up to you. You can like, comment, subscribe, share us around with all your friends. Rejoice in the Christmas spirit, I say.
And let us know your thoughts on A Christmas Carol and what did you think of it. And if there's anything we may have missed, you can discuss it in the comment section.
Yeah. And if you want just an entire episode of Jason singing Christmas carols, we can make that happen too.
Yes. Let us know what your favorite Christmas carol is so we know which one we need to get Jason to sing.
Yeah.
But until next time. Oh, yeah. We also have a website, www.bookwave.club. But until next time.
Until next time.
Until next time. May the force be with you.
Or happy holidays. The mass times success. What? Last time you saw Richard.
Happy holidays, everyone.
And oh, Merry Christmas.
Oh, bah humbug.